From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They may grow up together, share hula hoops and parents, but American siblings routinely end up on very different rungs of America's economic ladder. In a provocative new book, sociologist Dalton Conley says 75% of American economic disparity falls within families, between siblings. Think of it as the Bill Clinton-Roger Clinton syndrome writ large. Siblings do not succeed equally by a long shot, and the reasons are far more complex than simple birth order. Coming from a large family is a disadvantage for middle children, says Conley. Family trauma tends to make winners and losers. Working mothers tend to diminish difference between siblings. Tonight on Point, understanding the family pecking order and the yawning gaps in sibling success. How does it work in your family? Is child number one the number one success story, or is the baby of the family making out like a bandit? Do you see wildly different levels of success among your own brothers and sisters? How do you explain those differences? Is it counterintuitive to you that most of America's economic disparities fall within families, between siblings? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dalton Conley is a professor of sociology and public policy at New York University. He's an adjunct professor of community medicine at Mount Sinai School of Medicine and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. His new book is The Pecking Order, Which Siblings Succeed and Why. Good evening and welcome, Dalton Conley.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So it's right there in your title, Which Siblings Succeed and Why. Is there a simple answer to that, Dalton?
You just gave three very good reasons right off the bat in your intro, and that's just three among many. So there is no one reason. And anyone who's trying to tell you that there is one magic formula like birth order, which is one of our favorites in society, or even astrological sign, or even just simply gender, which does hold water but isn't the one factor. Anyone who tells you there's just one factor is just selling you a bottle of snake oil to make you feel better.
So what's the common wisdom that you set out to test here, Dalton Conley, in your book, The Pecking Order?
Well, there's several common wisdoms, and one of them is that we all start out on the same footing at home. You know, we might like to think that America at writ large is an unequal playing field for people from different racial groups or different genders or different social class backgrounds. But we like to think, at least in our own home, there's a different logic, that we all start out on the same footing. And, you know, that's just not the case. You can't have a dog-eat-dog world of capitalism out there and then have completely different rules in the home. The outer world seeps in. The home is not a haven in a harsh world. It's part and parcel of that world of inequality in America. So that's one myth that I think that we cling to in America that's not true.
I guess that if this disparity is as widespread within families, between siblings, as you say, then this should come as no surprise to anybody with brothers and sisters. They should look to their left and look to the right and see it.
Well, they do with respect to their own families. When asked in a national survey that I use for my analysis, which relative of yours is the worst off, most people pick a sibling. That's the biggest category. When they are asked which relative of yours is the best off, people pick siblings more than any other category, more than distant cousins even. So they're aware of it in their own family. When they're asked why, they always give a very individualized answer. Oh, my brother's a lazy bum. You know, he doesn't have a work ethic. He doesn't know how to save. He has a poor orientation to the future.
Right.
All these individual level answers, because they think it's the anomaly. They think their own family is the anomaly. I'm here to tell them that actually, no, having these disparities between you and your sister or brother is the norm, not the exception.
Now, there's a temptation to think when one first comes to your thesis here, Dalton Conley, that what you're saying is that it's not about race or class or gender, that the diversity of incomes and economic disparities is fully represented within each family, yet that's not exactly what you're saying.
No, it's not. In fact, I'm a little bit afraid of being misread and becoming the token hero of the Heritage Foundation or some other right-wing group.
Yeah.
Because you could read it, if you just stop at that first statement, you could just read it and say, look, Conley's proven it. America's a land of opportunity. Even brothers and sisters turn out differently.
You may soon be a hood ornament on a Rolls Royce, Dalton Conley.
Right. That's not my intention. In fact, when you scratch below the surface there and you ask, well, then what does explain these differences between siblings from the same family? It turns out to be very much the same things that explain differences across families. So take race, for example. We normally think that race is something that completely varies across families and is constant within families. So, well, how can race even matter if there's these enormous disparities? Well, it turns out that, for example, within black families in America, there is a pigmentocracy, even within a given household, so that lighter-skinned siblings end up better off than darker-skinned siblings, on average, mimicking the outer world. So race even plays out differently within the family. And in fact, this is what actually brought me to the subject in the beginning, which was when I was doing other research on black-white differences in economic status and wealth, I found that this curious finding that black families have the largest disparities, factoring out other factors like the size of their families or how much money they have. But even at the same levels as whites, black families had bigger disparities between their siblings than did whites or Latinos. I was like, why is this? And I filed it away and came back to it.
And then you went, begin to paint this picture for us, wade into it. How do you begin to describe who's more likely to succeed among siblings? If it's not birth order, you're saying it doesn't matter if you're number one or if you're last.
Well, birth order, as we like to think about it in our popular imagination, as the firstborn, as the type A, parent-pleasing, aggressive, maybe more socially awkward, but more ambitious and maybe book smart leader,
right,
and the last born as the rebel and the social gregarious one and all that kind of jazz, that doesn't hold any water. I mean, whether or not that's true, I'll leave to the psychologist's debate, although they've
got a
hard
case. You mean they may have these characters, but it doesn't determine their success, quote-unquote, in life.
Right. In two sibling families, at least, those personality traits don't translate into getting more education, getting a more prestigious job, you know, accumulating more income and wealth. Their class status is not affected by any personality differences that may stem or may not stem from birth order.
In two sibling families, what about three,
right,
four, five?
Well, here's where birth order comes into the picture. Normally, people talk about it in this personality language, but really what birth order, where it matters is its relation to family size, because we all know that each family has a somewhat fixed pie. You know, parents can't just magically earn more money when they have an additional kid. They can try, but there's only 24 hours in a day. There's only a certain amount of family income, and when you add another kid to the stew, the pie is going to have to be sliced into smaller slices.
Everybody knows that.
Right. That's a given. But how it works out is that all the slices are not necessarily equal, because if you think about it, the firstborn get to spend at least some of their childhood as an only child before the others are born.
Even if it's just a year or two.
Right. And then the last born gets to spend some of its childhood as an only child, assuming that you can get the older kids the heck out of the house. And
does that make so much difference, even if you just have a year or two or three as an only child?
Well, yeah, they actually, it does make a difference. And they also have unique roles. They're competing from unique perspectives. The kids in the middle have a two-front war to wage for parental attention, time, money, et cetera. And they're the ones that get the squeeze when the resources get divided up smaller.
So you're saying in a larger family, middle children are less likely to be ultimately successful, relatively?
On average, you know, with a lot of other caveats and other factors that, as you mentioned in your intro, are more important. Lastborns from very large families tend to do very well on average. There tends to be a large gap between the second to last and last, and then the last ends up being doted upon by not just their parents, but by much older siblings often,
right,
and they end up very successful on average.
So, and when you say success, I guess it's pretty important to understand what exactly you mean by that, Dalton Cunley.
Well, I'm using a fairly narrow definition of success. I mean socioeconomic success. I mean class status, measured by education level, the prestige of one's occupation, how much money they make in a given year, and how much wealth they've accumulated. So I'm really talking about socioeconomics. I have nothing to say about happiness or spiritual fulfillment or social adjustment or, you know, basically who's happier.
All pretty profound issues unto themselves.
Yeah, that's
and someone much to be envied. So, but
I mean, in my own sibling case, for example, I certainly am on the top of the pecking order in terms of education and income with respect to my own sister.
Yeah.
But she certainly trumps me when it comes to happiness and fulfillment, I would say.
So you're not talking about who's the best person, who's the best human being, who's the happiest human being, certainly, or the most fulfilled, or the most giving, or the most wondrous. You're talking basically about who's got the best education and the biggest paycheck.
Exactly. Now, I would love to have talked about those other things, but they're just notoriously difficult to measure. How do you measure who's the best person? But I can measure how much money you take home.
Right. And there we go. One measure of success. And, of course, it's one that everybody can see. And I suppose people – well, I wanted to ask you, is this something – do you find in all your interviews – and you did a lot of interviews for this, I read do siblings compare each other very minutely and closely, or do they have so many other measures of one another beyond finances, let's say, because they know each other so intimately that the paycheck's not that big a deal between siblings? Or is it?
Well, I think it is. I think there are lifelong resentments where one sibling – maybe unfairly rationalizes, or maybe it is true that they think that they got the short shrift from their parents, and maybe they didn't get extracurricular activities paid for, or they weren't sent to private school like their brother, and they use that to explain the fact that their brother now earns twice the amount of money they do.
And they carry that all their lives.
Craw. Yeah.
Wow.
It does seem, I mean, people come to terms with it, and I hope actually this book will help them come to terms with it even more. To realize that they're not crazy, that there were inequities in the family, and every kid experiences the family growing up differently. The family is changing. Parents don't know always what they're doing in terms of creating biases within the family. But we found some pretty long-lasting lifetime resentments going on there.
As I read you, the way I understood you was families that are really loaded, that have a lot of money to begin with, are going to see likely less disparity in the success levels of their children. Families who come from the most disadvantaged starting place are likely to see greater disparity in their children's success. Is that right?
Exactly. So that's another way that the Heritage Foundation's adoption of me would be incorrect.
And why is that?
Sibling inequality is not created equally in itself, because the parenting strategies become different when you have limited resources as opposed when you have a cornucopia of them. So if you're the Clintons, Virginia Clinton in particular, and you have limited resources and you're...
This is Bill Clinton's family growing up,
Bill
and
Clinton's
the father's
mom.
Gone and the life is tough.
And nasty stepdad and all that, and not a lot of education, not a lot of money. It might be rational to put all your eggs in the one kid who you think is the golden child, who you think might make it out of Arkansas or the ghetto or wherever, or a small working class town. So that is a reasonable, rational strategy that is pursued.
So you're saying disadvantaged families may pour more resources into the one or two children who seem to have the best chance of making it out of that status.
Exactly.
Whereas affluent families?
The exact opposite dynamic, compensation. So if you've got enough to make sure that the kids who are doing well can just kind of hum along, then you take your extra resources, you devote your attention and your money and your social connections and power to bringing up the laggard in the family. So not to be too partisan, I can give you two examples of this, the Bushes and the Kennedys, just to use both sides of the political divide there. Bush's early adulthood resume was not that unlike Roger Clinton's, the ne'er-do-well.
True.
Alcoholic, busted for drunk driving, rumors about other drug use.
Yep.
Didn't hold down a steady job, kind of had a couple failed businesses, even though he walked away richer.
And yet he's president now.
You're right. If he were born to Virginia Clinton, he'd probably be, not that different
because
from
Roger. He wouldn't
today.
Have been born up on wings of angels and money and support from around him.
Being a Bush raised his boat to the level of Jeb or past that. And Jeb, his brother, governor of Florida, was really the star of the family the whole time. He was the one who graduated from at 20 with honors and then, started a successful real estate business.
Dalton Conley, I want you to hold the Kennedy story. We'll come to it. We're talking tonight with sociologist Dalton Conley. His new book is The Pecking Order, Which Siblings Succeed and Why. How does it look in your family? Is child number one in success, or is it the baby of the family who's making out like a bandit? Do you see wildly different levels of success among your own brothers and sisters? Why? What do you think has made the difference? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about siblings and success. My guest is sociologist Dalton Conley. He joins us from New York. His new book is The Pecking Order, Which Siblings Succeed and Why. You can join our conversation tonight. Is birth order overrated as a predictor of success? Do you buy that large families are destined to produce more losers in those middle ranks? And how have you ended up at the top or the bottom of the sibling pecking order in your family? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dalton Conley, you've given us the Bush family picture, George Bush being born up by an affluent, that even rich family, and the particular dynamic there. How does the Kennedy family figure into your formula?
In a very similar way, in that Jack, JFK, mm-hmm. was the sickly second-born. He was not the one expected to do great things. In fact, his father wrote him that when he was in prep school, saying, you know, don't worry, don't feel the pressure. I don't expect you to amount to much, essentially, because all his eggs were in the basket of Joe Jr., the firstborn male.
The sainted Joe who died in World War II.
Exactly. And the moment that he died in World War II, the mantle fell upon JFK to fulfill his father's dreams. And, of course, there was an enormous amount of resources behind those dreams. And as, you know, he famously quipped that he bought him a victory, not a landslide, in the 1960 election. Mm-hmm. Joe Sr. made sure that JFK fulfilled the promise of a Kennedy president. And the rest is history. I mean, once Kennedy was in, then as a sibling, he influenced his other siblings. We wouldn't have heard of Bobby had JFK not become president and appointed him attorney general, and likewise on down to Ted. So despite incredibly negative things even happening in Ted's career, for example, with Chappaquiddick, he's now the second, or now that Strom Thurmond's gone, I think the first most senior senator in the U.S. Senate.
So a lot of money can ameliorate these differences, but most families don't have that much, and many have little, and there you see enormous differences. Dalton Conley, we have a ton of callers who want to join this conversation. They must be siblings, I'm guessing. I want to invite
hopefully
them
not all angry middle-borns.
Well, we'll see. Paul is calling from Boston. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Good evening. How are you?
Very well, thanks, Paul.
Great. Great discussion tonight. You know, I find this interesting in that I have a brother and a sister, and I'm the youngest and probably viewed as the most successful. And I look at it in talking with my friends as more environment and genetics, if that makes sense, in that my father is very blue-collar.
Okay.
And so is it my brother.
Yeah.
They have very similar traits. They look similar. They think the same way. My mother, on the other hand, is a school teacher, college-educated.
Right.
Both my sister and I have gone on to get our master's degrees.
So you're looking at genetics and saying your brother's a chip off the old blue-collar block and it's been recreated in his life?
Yes, it has been. Also environment, in that I had a lot of mentors in my life that pushed me to go to college, where my brother was very much into the blue-collar crowd, would go out, you know, for beer after work with the guys, and was really not pushed in the direction of college.
Paul, I don't want to get too personal, but give us in broad stroke, how do you judge at this point in your life that you're more successful than your brother or sister?
Well, socioeconomic, as you were saying. I mean, I'm a corporate VP. I make $200,000 a year.
Okay.
My brother has a very good job, but he's a delivery person for, you know, one of the bread companies. Makes probably $45,000. My sister has made choices to be a teacher. She's very intelligent, but of course, as everyone knows, teachers are not compensated at the same level as corporate people.
So when you sit around at Thanksgiving or family reunions, is this in the air, Paul? Do you talk about it? Can you acknowledge it? Is it a topic of conversation at the grown-up family table?
Well, no, it's not. There's a little bit of animosity between my brother and I, but it's more driven by his wife and my wife, in that I've been successful and he's not. I think my brother's wife is a little jealous of that.
Right. It can come from many directions. Paul, stick with us. The doctor is in the house. Dr. Dalton Conley, give us your analysis of this family we've just heard sketched.
Well, we didn't hear the birth order, and that's fine because, like I said, birth order is overrated. But you know, what's more important is what the caller was pointing to, which is the fit between genetics and environment. Everyone wants to talk about the nature-nurture divide or the debate between them. And it's really a red herring because you can't talk about one without the other. They're two sides of the same coin. This family is a good example. I'll give you another example where a grown woman we interviewed was a violin prodigy from a very young age, from 4 or 5. Clearly genetic,
yeah.
Right? Just like this man's brother was a chip off the old, dad's working class block.
Right.
And because the mother had been in this villainous family, she had been a frustrated musician. She poured all her hopes and dreams into this particular child, kind of neglecting the other sister who didn't have that particular talent. So there was a very good fit between her talents and the values of her family. So they all poured any extra money into her career.
Made it easy to recognize and to know how to support her.
Right. They nurtured her properly within the family. They gave her. They spent all the extra money on the violin, expensive violins, and private tutoring lessons, yeah, et cetera. She made it to conservatory, but once she was in conservatory, she realized that, wow, I'm good, but I'm like maybe slightly better than average here. And unless in the classical music industry, unless you're one of the handful of very best violinists in the world or the country now, you're going to have a rough life ahead of you of, you know, insecure employment and all that. And so that's what she had because
the daughter who got all the attention didn't end up on your yardstick the most successful.
Exactly. It backfired. There's a three-level chess game going on. There's who gets the attention within the family and whose innate abilities are valued by that family. You could be a hockey star, but be born into a family of cerebral mathematicians,
and
never even recognize you. But they won't buy you the hockey stick because they think it's a waste of time,
versa. Right, but let me ask you about something else that Paul is referencing here. When he says it's genetics and environment, he's as I hear you, Paul, he's suggesting I'm a chip off the block of my mother, who's more cerebral, more studies oriented. He's seeing his success as the degree to which, in some sense, he's more has greater affinity with a more success-oriented parent. If I heard him right, does that add up to you, Dalton Conley?
Well, I took something a little different away. I took that I focused on his brother, and his brother had a good relationship with his father, clearly reproduced his father's abilities or whatever, and because that was a working class environment or working class dad, he ended up emulating his father, so in a sense he was the right match for his father, but the match with the wider world, like the violinist, was a bad fit.
Yeah.
So his skills were not valued in the marketplace, unlike the brother and sister.
Paul, I want to ask you something. I may ask others tonight. So you've got the big paycheck in the family. You know your brother and sister very well. Life is long, and you come to know with time that success, what seems like success one day doesn't look so great the next day. Do you feel that you've just ended up a better person or just a bigger paycheck? Do you feel at the end of your life you're going to feel I had a more successful life or I had a more financially rewarding life?
No, I think that my brother is a very good person, and I feel the same way about myself. I think that both of our lives are rewarding. I just think that, my mother is very intelligent. I'm very intelligent. But I think if I had stayed in the same town,
right,
gone to work, in a blue collar job, that I could have ended up the same way as my brother. Even though, I think genetically I got my mother's brains and savvy for business.
And you're off and running in a kind of illustration of exactly what Dalton Conley is talking about. Paul, thanks very much for your call. Christina is calling from Hebron, Illinois. Hi, Christina. You're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
How are you guys?
Great, thanks.
Great conversation.
Good.
I'm the oldest of four.
Okay.
And my parents were divorced when I was in college. And my youngest brother has, just what you said, he's benefited from being the youngest and kind of being doted on by everyone.
Yeah.
And he is the more socioeconomic successful child. And me, the oldest, I'm more of the, I've always worked for nonprofit organizations, and I've been kind of the innovator and the grassroots person in the family, and so I'm limited in the socio and economic area, but high on the rewards and the giving. And
I hear it, Christina. Christina, let me ask you something. Do you feel that you were at some level shortchanged because you weren't youngest in the family, because the divorce hit the family? How exactly do you feel shortchanged?
Once I got out of college, my mom was, taking care of three other ones, and she was very ready for me to be on my way. And Timmy, my youngest brother, he stayed at home until he was almost 30.
Wow.
He was able to complete his degree, and he's definitely the looked down upon as more of a successful one.
Right.
But I feel that if I would have had that opportunity, I too would have been able to obtain higher education and without having to feed my family and everything like that. So
right. So you were on your own in a hurry.
Yes.
It ended up with you having a smaller paycheck. On the other hand, you ended up with a kind of empathy that made you good at your nonprofit work, I'm hearing.
Exactly.
Christina, exactly. We've got to let me put this case to Dalton Conley, and thanks very much for sharing it with us. Dalton, you write about the effects of traumas on family, divorce counting as one.
Yes, divorce being the most common these days, a parental death maybe in the beginning of the century, of the last century being the more common one then.
How do those tend to ripple through sibling accomplishment or success, as you define it?
They definitely create differences between the siblings because obviously it occurs at different points, critical points for each sibling depending on how old they are when it happens. And actually, Christina illustrates what I talk about in terms of the Cinderella effect, which is often when this kind of a divorce or a parental death occurs, the eldest child, particularly if they're still at home, it sounded like Christina had maybe already left the nest or maybe was going to college from home, but particularly when they're still at home, the eldest child, and particularly when she's female, gets burdened with responsibilities, looking after the other kids, literally doing housework like Cinderella, or becoming even an emotional crutch or support in processing the trauma for the kids and for the remaining parents.
So they're not necessarily nurtured, but become kind of co-parents or supports, as you say, crutch even.
Exactly. In fact, it's kind of interesting that she went into sort of charitable work because that's exactly the kind of role that these eldest females often take and become overburdened by them and then make sacrifices and suffer in the long run vis-a-vis their siblings. In fact, the story of Cinderella, she escapes and achieves great success only through magic, you know, fairy godmother
right.
and a magic slipper. Most of us in reality don't have that. So if you get stuck being Cinderella, you usually end up staying that way unless something else happens to shock the family again, like remarriage or upward mobility of some sort.
And as a wide pattern, not just while you're young, but potentially for life.
Yeah, I mean, depending on when it happens, it can have enormous repercussions for the rest of your life. It can happen. It can disrupt your attempts to go to college, for example. Then, of course, that will have a major repercussion.
Christina, hang right in there. Thanks for your call. Ed is calling from Boston. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Great. Thanks.
I just wanted to say that I'm the youngest of two children.
Okay.
I came from a divorced family. My mother got divorced when I was about 7.
Yeah.
My brother's 5 years older than I am. And I feel parental exposure really has a lot to do with it because I pretty much hung out with my mother. You know, we both live with my mother.
I'm sorry.
But I pretty much stayed with my mother.
So you hung out with her more?
More, exactly. My mother pretty much took me places with her, you know, kind of, I guess, you know, just took me places with her. My brother polarized more towards my father,
so this,
who wasn't the nicest of people.
So in the context of the divorce, you gravitated toward different parents. You to the mom,
exactly.
he to dad, and dad didn't turn out to be as nurturing or supportive. Is that what you're saying?
Well, what I'm saying is that my brother seemed to follow the path of my father, which was really not to be too successful and kind of somewhat repeat the mistakes that my father made. And I think that I kind of said, well, I'm not going to go that route. I don't want to make those mistakes, and I want to, you know, I guess be better.
Have you ended up more successful by Dalton Conley's education income yardstick, Ed?
I would say financially speaking, I probably make about 4 times more than he does. And it had nothing to do with the amount of money that was spent on us because, again, we didn't have any money.
Ed, have you?
I financed my own education.
Yeah. Ed, have you ever talked with your brother very explicitly about this?
My brother is kind of funny. He's really a lot like my father. He doesn't like talking about it. And any sore subjects, really more towards avoidance.
Do you think
I rather like to grab the bull by the horns,
yep.
you know, and just say, hey, you know, this is the way it is, you know.
Even if he's
you
not
don't
talking,
like it too bad.
Even if he's not talking about it, do you think he knows it or that he sees it the same way?
I think that, I think my brother tries to constantly convince himself that he's not like our father, but he really is a lot like him in a lot of ways, and one being that he just doesn't want to correct the mistakes that our father made. You know, use it as an example.
Yeah, yep. Ed, we've
maybe
got
he doesn't know any better, maybe because he just knows what he learned from hanging out with my father. I kind of really never hung out with my father because I didn't particularly like the man, because I like my mother more.
Ed, we've got it, and we thank you for your call and your observation. Dalton Conley, I'm fascinated at how it appears people really think about this, and they have their own theories about what has happened and why it's happened. What do you hear in Ed's story?
Well, what's interesting to me is when we started doing the interviews with the 175 siblings from 68 families, we started with the first four families, I think it was, interviewing the parents as well, if they were still alive, or whatever parent was still alive. And when we interviewed them, we got this, name, rank, and serial number. You just, I love all my children equally.
Right.
They are all successful. How could you even imply that they're not all successful?
Right.
You know, the party line, like they had been socialized in some cult. And so we quickly dropped that, realizing that's just a waste of time talking to them. But when we talked to the siblings, we got all the real dirt, the kind of lifelong resentments and suspicions and the kind of things that the analysis that Ed is providing. And I expected for sibling A, for Ed to say, oh, yeah, you know, my brother was the favorite one. And then the brother to say, no, it was Ed who was the favorite one. I'm the one who really got the short shrift.
Right.
And it turned out that people were remarkably in line, in concordance with who was the favored child and who was the scapegoat or the bad seed, so to speak.
So the siblings all knew, or at least they shared an understanding,
the
perspective.
The pecking order was sort of agreed to among the siblings. But what wasn't agreed to, and this is speaking to Ed's comment, was cause and effect. So I'd be very curious if Ed's brother thinks that he was chose to be with the father, the less savory of the parents, or whether he was thrust into that role because he's older and he had to maybe nurture his father in a way, or his father was more vulnerable. Because the black sheep of the family will often say, I was the scapegoat. My parents really were hard on me, and that's why I got into trouble, and that's why I'm no good. I'm less successful now. Meanwhile, the siblings are saying, "Oh yeah, John, he was terrible from birth, from his crib," and reverse the cause and effect, say that he was only picked on more by his parents because he, quote, deserved it.
Well, I'm not sure what happened in Ed's family. We're not going to know tonight, but we can see a lot of analysis going on there. And I can see from the way our phone banks are filling up, a lot of people's wheels are turning about their relationships with their siblings, their success in life, and how it relates to your thesis here. We're talking tonight with Dalton Conley. His new book is The Pecking Order, Which Siblings Succeed and Why. Do you see wildly different levels of success among your own brothers and sisters? Why? What do you think has made the difference? And is it counterintuitive to you that most of America's economic disparities fall within families, between siblings? You can join us tonight, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about siblings and success. My guest is Dalton Conley, sociologist at New York University and author of the new book, The Pecking Order, Which Siblings Succeed and Why. You can join the conversation. How do you define success in your family? Do you all define it in the same way? How have you ended up at the top or the bottom of the sibling pecking order in your family? Do our sibling status, our sibling rivalries, ever leave us? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Andrea is calling from Holliston, Massachusetts. Hi, Andrea. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I'm the oldest of three.
Yeah.
And I definitely think that I'm like the most successful. I mean, all around, I would say monetarily and like happiness wise out of my siblings.
And why do you think that is, Andrea? Why?
I don't know. I don't think that really our parents raised us any differently. Like, they definitely didn't like put one through college and not the other. We all had to pay through our own way. We were allowed to stay at home as long as we want. Actually, my brother still lives at home. He's the middle child.
So was luck involved somehow here?
What's that?
Do you think it could be luck?
I think part of it's luck, part of it's drive. Wanting to get out and make things better.
Yep.
I'm not really sure. I can say that my mom definitely sympathized with my brother a lot more because my mom was a middle child and my brother's a middle child.
Right.
And my sister was the baby, and of course, you know, the babies always get spoiled. But I don't think, other than that, I really don't think that they treated us any differently.
Andrew, we've got it. And that's interesting right in itself. I want to thank you for your call. Darton Conley, how about this? I mean, here Andrea says, I think I'm the most successful, but I really can't point to a framework or a reason why. That must be common. It must not always be easy to look around and say, well, here's A, B, and C, why I or he or she is at the top of the pile.
Yeah, I mean, she's a classic example of the pattern we found with respect to the transition from 2 to 3 kids and the impact on the middle born. She claims that the financial investment by the parents was the same, but we found that when you talk about the transition from a 2-kid family to a 3-kid family, mm-hmm. the firstborn suffered no decreased investment, but the middle born was then 25% less likely to have private school tuition paid, and they were many times more likely to be held back a grade than if
wow.
it had just remained a 2-kid family. So they were bearing the brunt of the sort of the pie being sliced to make room for an additional piece. So sometimes people might not be aware of the patterns, you know, until maybe they read a study and they say, oh, that looks, now that you mention it, my brother didn't get, you know, extracurricular activities paid for or something like that.
Maybe that applies to me. Let me get another call here. Andrew's calling from Boston. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you?
Great. Thanks.
Good. Well, I appreciate the conversation, and it kind of a woman had called in earlier, and I kind of had to sympathize with her in that, you know, the death of a family, a death of my father when I was younger, had uh-huh. I think had a large impact on both my brother and I. And
what's the outcome been?
Well, my brother is my older brother, and there's only two of us. And my dad was had cancer, and when I was about 5, and my brother was 7, and my mom at that point had decided to send me to Florida because she couldn't handle kind of him being sick and
right.
taking care of both kids.
Right.
And then I went to Florida to live with my aunt and uncle and was kind of isolated from the whole issue.
And who do you think ended up more successful on these terms, Andrew?
Well, you know, I felt like my brother really felt the brunt of the relationship with my father, and he ended up, you know, I went to, you know, a really great school and ended up, you know, going to graduate school, and now I work for a venture capital company in Boston. And he, after college, we both went to private high schools.
Yeah.
He, after college, ended up having to go out to, you know, the West Coast and to Montana and kind of find himself for 5 or 6 years before he really was able to enter the workforce.
He really,
I feel like he got the brunt of the, you know, impact of the death of my father.
Yeah, our time is short, but we've got it, Andrew. Your brother ended up growing up more in the trauma zone than you. Dalton Conley, our time is so short, I want to go straight to a couple of conclusions here. One, if there's all this difference between siblings, do you find that it drives families apart, or do families just live with it?
Well, I think this is optimistic, that a lot of them just live with it, which is better than never speaking to each other again.
Sure is.
We did a little study where we tried to see if the class differences between siblings resulted in them living in separate social worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we reproduced the survey in the back of the book. And what it is 250 last names. They happen to be the 501st to 750th most common last name in the U.S. Census,
okay.
minus Conley. I actually took my own last name out of there. It happened to be number 503. And then gave them to all the siblings and asked them, well, who do you know with this last name? And to the extent that their social networks overlap, they would both have checked, you know,
right.
Jones or Conley or
yeah.
whoever.
Yeah.
And to the extent that they were living in separate worlds, they would have very few or if not any
yeah.
In
yeah.
common. And we yeah. thought that the wider the disparity in a particular family, the less they would have their social worlds in
Got
common.
It.
It didn't turn out to be the case.
So they still overlap.
So they still overlap. But we did also find that when a sibling has a very high prestige job, you know, a kind of demanding professional career, as compared to their less prestigious sibling occupations, they tend to socialize less with their family. They tend to socialize more with their colleagues and friends.
And off so they float. Exactly. Don Connolly, our time is short. I guess I want to end just on the thought that I guess my hope would be that in the intimacy, the kind of deep human understanding that siblings know each other, they would see success in very nuanced and varied ways. I mean, even education and income really can't capture that whole spectrum, can they?
Of course not. I think that's great that siblings can come to terms with varying levels of economic success and, you know, other important qualities like
And with that, we've got to go, Dalton Connolly. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Dalton Connolly at NYU. You can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org. Coming up, Jack Beatty joins me to look back at the week's news. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
We're looking at television footage now of people with bloodied faces, people being walked or carried away from one or more of the stations. Again, mind you, there was a series of explosions. The accounts that are coming in now off the radio and the television are just absolutely horrific.
This was such a breakthrough in terms of the region, in terms of Iraq. Just imagine an administrative law that enshrines for the Iraqi people a Bill of Rights, freedom, openness.
We're just beginning to fight here. These guys are the most crooked, you know, lying group I've ever seen.
A president sets his agenda for America in the first 100 days. John Kerry's plan? To pay for new government spending, raise taxes by at least $900 billion. John Kerry, wrong on taxes, wrong on defense.
No reasonable person would disagree that using a performance enhancing substance to gain a competitive edge over an opponent is cheating. Sports organizations that allow athletes to cheat through weak drug testing regimes are aiding and abetting cheaters.
We are saying enough is enough. H.R. 3717 sends a clear signal to the entertainment industry. We're no longer going to idly stand by and force our parents to put up with this filth.
Are we going to have, across the board, tough budget rules to protect the taxpayer dollars? Or are we going to have holes in those rules that will make sure that the taxpayers get in a deeper, deeper hole?
Lawmakers backing no try to commandeer the National Assembly podium to prevent a vote from taking place.
Obviously, courts can make some finding about same-sex marriages. They can also decide in the legislature or by initiative petition. There are a variety of ways to change the law. In our view, was very simply as a law enforcer in California that those are the appropriate ways to do it, not unilateral action by one county.
And there's a week. A major terrorist attack hits Madrid as a series of train blasts kill at least 199 in Spain. Colin Powell hails the signing of an interim constitution in Iraq. The tone of the presidential race turns negative as John Kerry calls his Republican opponents crooked and lying into a microphone he may not have known was still on. And President Bush launches his first attack ad. Senator John McCain warns Major League Baseball officials to create a better system for testing players for steroids or risk Congress stepping in. The House approves much steeper fines for broadcasters who break indecency rules up to $500,000 per violation. The Senate passes new procedural rules that will make it harder for President Bush's tax cuts to be made permanent. Fisticuffs break out in South Korea's National Assembly during a vote to impeach President No-Moo-Hyun. And California's Supreme Court halts San Francisco's issuing of marriage licenses to same-sex couples. Jack Beatty joins me tonight from California. How does the week look from the Golden West, Jack?
Well, golden. I mean, it has been in the low 80s here with absolute sunshine and just lives up to its reputation, especially when you come from the East Coast, when you come from New Hampshire.
you're in Lotus Land. And yet tough stuff this week, and above all in Madrid.
Yes, and did you notice that the self-identified Al-Qaeda communication to the London-based newspaper, it warned that plans for an attack on the United States are, quote, 90% completed. Now, that could just be, you know, the usual empty threat. On the other hand, it does raise the question, one of the imponderables of this election. E.J. Dionne on our program some weeks ago said that this may not be a close election. He had the feeling it could, if some big outside event supervenes, and whether an attack would be such an event, and whether and what effect that would have on the election, we just don't know.
It is interesting that the bombings in Spain came just 2 or 3 days before a big general election there.
Yes, isn't that something? And, of course, now I think they are saying it looks like it's a Basque separatist group, but who knows?
Can you imagine how the American electorate would be rocked if it was trying to deal emotionally with some terror attack and gather itself for a vote at the same time? It's hard to imagine a more unsettling notion for a democracy.
Really, and it's just hard to imagine that it would be anything but beneficial to the incumbent, since people simply want to always want to rally around the president in a moment like that. And I can't see how it could work to Senator Kerry's advantage, although we were talking to people out here in the Hoover Institute, and they said, well, he could say, you haven't done a good job. So who knows?
Let's hope and pray that it doesn't become an issue. Lots of action on the gay marriage front in California this week, Jack, while you've been out there.
Yes. The California Supreme Court stopped San Francisco's issuing of marriage licenses until they have decided on the propriety and constitutionality of that. And that's to be decided in a few months. And their constitution, as the Massachusetts Constitution and as the U.S. Constitution, has an equal protection of the laws clause or amendment. And that amendment to the U.S. Constitution reads this way: no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. You know, that statement, the equal protection of the laws, has been a mighty river of rights, because it constitutionalizes one of the basic principles of American political culture: equality before the law. And you could see that if this ever gets to the Supreme Court in one way or another, either through an appeal of a statute or an appeal about a state constitutional amendment, the court has been widening rights consistently under that heading in the field of abortion rights, corporate law, and in gay rights. And I went back and looked at last year's gay rights decision striking down the Texas law criminalizing homosexual behavior. Mm-hmm. And here it says, had those who drew and ratified the 14th Amendment known the components of liberty in its manifold possibilities, they might have been more specific. They did not presume to have this insight. They knew the times can blind us to truths that later generations will see.
Equal Protection Clause is not going to go away. Whatever happens with this wave of resistance to gay marriage, there could be a collision there, Jack.
That's what people were saying out here, that state after state may find this collision between that clause and that impulse in our political culture and the traditional idea of marriage.
Well, we will be watching. Jack Beatty in California, thanks so much for being with us tonight. See you back here on the East Coast soon.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.